Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 7 of Three Men in a Boat.
We played Morceau from old German masters. We discussed philosophy and ethics. We flirted with graceful dignity. We were even humorous in a high-class way. Someone recited a French poem after supper, and we said it was beautiful. And then a lady sang a sentimental ballad in Spanish, and it made one or two of us weep, it was so pathetic. And then those two young men got up and asked us if we had ever heard Erschlossen Bolschen, who had just arrived and was then down in the supper room, sing his great German comic song. None of us had heard it that we could remember. The young men said it was the funniest song they had ever been written, and that if we liked, they would get Herr Schlossen Bolschen, whom they knew very well, to sing it. They said it was so funny that when Herr Schlossen Bolschen had sung it once before the German emperor, he, the German emperor, had had to be carried off to bed. They said nobody could sing it like Herr Schlossen Bolschen. He was so intensely serious all through it that you might fancy he was reciting a tragedy, and that, of course, made it all the funnier. They said he never once suggested by his tone or manner that he was singing anything funny that would spoil it. It was his air of seriousness, almost of pathos, that made it so irresistibly amusing. We said we yearned to hear it, that we wanted a good laugh, and they went downstairs and fetched Erschlossen Bolschen. He appeared to be quite pleased to sing, for he came up at once and sat down to the piano without another word. "Oh, it will amuse you. You will laugh," whispered the two young men as they passed through the room and took up an unobtrusive position behind the professor's back. Erschlossen Bolschen accompanied himself. The prelude did not suggest a comic song exactly. It was a weird, soulful air. It quite made one's flesh creep. But we murmured to one another that it was the German method and prepared to enjoy it. I don't understand German myself. I learned it at school, but forgot every word of it 2 years after I'd left, and have felt much better ever since. Still, I did not want the people there to guess my ignorance, so I hit upon what I thought to be a rather good idea. I kept my eye on the two students and followed them. When they tittered, I tittered. When they roared, I roared. And I also threw in a little snigger all by myself now and then, as if I had seen a bit of humor that escaped the others. I considered this particularly artful on my part. I noticed as the song progressed that a good many other people seemed to have their eye fixed on the two men as well as myself. These other people tittered when the young men tittered, and roared when the young men roared, and as the two young men tittered and roared and exploded with laughter pretty continuously all through the song, it went exceedingly well. And yet that German professor did not seem happy. At first, when he began to laugh, the expression on his face was one of intense surprise, as if laughter were the very last thing he had expected to be greeted with. We thought this was very funny. We said his earnest manner was half the humor. The slightest hint on his part that he knew how funny he was would have completely ruined it all. As we continued to laugh, his surprise gave way to an air of annoyance and indignation, and he scowled fiercely around us, except upon the two young men who, being behind him, he could not see. That sent us into convulsions. We told each other that it would be the death of us, this thing. The words alone, we said, were enough to send us into fits, but added to his mock seriousness, oh, it was too much. In the last verse, he surpassed himself. He glowered round upon us with a look of such concentrated ferocity that, but for our being forewarned as to the German method of comic singing, we should have been nervous. And he threw such a wailing note of agony into the weird music that, if we had not known it was a funny song, we might have wept. He finished amid a perfect shriek of laughter. We said it was the funniest thing we had ever heard in all our lives. We said how strange it was that, in the face of things like these, there should be a popular notion that the Germans hadn't any sense of humor. And we asked the professor why he didn't translate the song into English so that the common people could understand it and hear what a real comic song was like. Then Herr Schlossenbroschen got up and went on awful. He swore at us in German, which I should judge to be a singular effective language for that purpose, and he danced and shook his fists and called us all the English he knew. He said he never had been so insulted in all his life. It appeared that the song was not a comic song at all. It was about a young girl who lived in the Harz Mountains and who had given up her life to save her lover's soul. He died and met her spirit in the air, and then in the last verse he jilted her spirit and went on with another spirit. I'm not quite sure of the details, but it was something very sad, I know. Herr Boschen said he had sung it once before the German emperor, and he, the German emperor, had sobbed like a little child. He, Herr Boschen, said it was generally acknowledged to be one of the most tragic and pathetic songs in the German language. It was a trying situation for us, very trying. There seemed to be no answer. We looked around for the two men who had done this thing, but they had left the house in an unostentatious manner, immediately after the end of the song. That was the end of the party. I never saw a party break up so quietly and with so little fuss. We never said good night even to one another. We came downstairs one at a time, walking softly and keeping to the shady side. We asked the servant for our hats and coats in whispers and opened the door for ourselves and slipped out, and got round the corner quickly, avoiding each other as much as possible. I have never taken much interest in German songs since then. We reached the Sunbury Lock at 3:30. The river is sweetly pretty just there before you come to the gates, and the backwater is charming, but don't attempt to row up it. I tried to do so once. I was sculling and asked the fellows who were steering if they thought it could be done, and they said, oh yes, they thought so, if I pulled hard. We were just under the little footbridge that crosses it between the two weirs when they said this, and I bent down to the sculls and I set myself up and pulled. I pulled splendidly. I got well into a steady rhythmical swing. I put my arms and my legs and my back into it. I set myself a good, quick, dashing stroke, and worked in really grand style. My two friends said it was a pleasure to watch me. At the end of 5 minutes, I thought we ought to be pretty near the weir, and I looked up. We were under the bridge in exactly the same spot that we were when I began, and there were those two idiots injuring themselves by violent laughing. I had been grinding away like mad to keep the boat stuck still under that bridge. I let other people pull up backwaters against the strong stream now. We sculled up to Walton, a rather large place for a riverside town. As with all riverside places, only the tiniest corner of it comes down to the water, so that from the boat you might fancy it was a village of some half-dozen houses, all told. Windsor and Abingdon are the only towns between London and Oxford that you can really see anything of from the stream. All the others hide around corners and merely peep at the river down one street. My thanks to them for being so considerate and leaving the river banks to woods and fields and waterworks. Even Reading, though it does its best to spoil and sully and make hideous as much of the river as it can reach, is good-natured enough to keep its ugly face a good deal out of sight. Czars, of course, had a little place at Walton, a camp or an entrenchment or something of that sort. Czar was a regular upriver man. Also Queen Elizabeth, she was there too. You can never get away from that woman, go where you will. Cromwell and Bradshaw, not the guide man but the King Charles head man, likewise sojourned there. They must have been quite a pleasant little party altogether. There is an iron scold's bridle in the Walton church. They used those things in the ancient days for curbing women's tongues. They have given up the attempt now. I suppose iron was getting scarce, and nothing else would be strong enough. There are also tombs of note in the church, and I was afraid I should never get Harris past them. But he didn't seem to think of them, and we went on. Above the bridge the river winds tremendously. This makes it look picturesque, but it irritates you from a towing or sculling point of view, and causes argument between the man who is pulling and the man who is steering. You pass Oatlands Park on the right bank there. It's a famous old place. Henry VIII stole it from someone or other, I forget whom now, and lived in it. There is a grotto on the park where you can see, for a fee, and which is supposed to be very wonderful, but I cannot see much in it myself. The late Duchess of York, who lived at Oatlands, was very fond of dogs and kept an immense number. She had a special graveyard made in which to bury them when they died, and there they lie, about 50 of them, with a tombstone over each and an epitaph inscribed thereon. Well, I dare say they deserved it, quite as much as the average Christian does. At Corway Stakes, the first bend above Walton Bridge, was fought a battle between Czars and Cassivellaunus. Cassivellaunus had prepared the river for Czars by planting it full of stakes, and had no doubt put up a notice board. But Czars crossed in spite of this. You couldn't choke Czars off that river. He's the sort of man we want around the backwaters now. Halley Ford and Shepperton are both pretty little spots where they touch the river, but there is nothing remarkable about either of them. There is a tomb in Shepperton churchyard, however, with a poem on it, and I was nervous lest Harris should want to get out and fool around it. I saw him fix a longing eye on the landing stage as we drew near it, so I managed by an adroit movement to jerk his cap into the water, and in the excitement of recovering that and his indignation at my clumsiness, he forgot all about his beloved graves. At Weybridge, the Wey, a pretty little stream, navigable for small boats up to Guildford, and one which I have always been making up my mind to explore and never have. The Bourne and Basingstoke Canal all enter the Thames together. The lock is just opposite the town, and the first thing that we saw when we came into view of it was George's blazer on one of the lock gates, closer inspection showing that George was inside of it. Montmorency set up a furious barking. I shrieked. Harris roared. George waved his hat and yelled back. The lock keeper rushed out with a drag, under the impression that somebody had fallen into the lock, and appeared annoyed at finding that no one had. George had rather a curious oilskin-covered parcel in his hand. It was round and flat at one end, and a long straight handle sticking out of it. "What's that?" said Harris. "Is it a frying pan?" "No," said George, with a strange, wild look glittering in his eyes. "They are all the rage this season. Everybody has got them up the river. It's a banjo." "I never knew you played the banjo," cried Harris and I in one breath. "Not exactly," replied George, "but it's very easy, they tell me, and I've got an instruction book." Chapter 9. We made George work, now we had got him. He did not want to work, of course. That goes without saying. He had had a hard time in the city, so he explained. Harris, who is callous in his nature and not prone to pity, said, "Ah, and now you are going out to have a hard time on the river for a change. Change is good for everyone. Out you get." He could not in conscience, not even George's conscience, object, though he did suggest that perhaps it would be better for him to stop in the boat and get tea ready, while Harris and I towed, because getting tea was such worrying work, and Harris and I looked tired. The only reply we made to this, however, was to pass him over the tow line, and he took it and stepped out. There is something very strange and unaccountable about a tow line. You roll it up with as much patience and care as you would take to fold up a new pair of trousers, and 5 minutes afterwards, when you pick it up, it is one ghastly, soul-revolting tangle. I do not wish to be insulting, but I firmly believe that if you took an average tow line and stretched it out straight across the middle of a field, and then turned your back on it for 30 seconds, that, when you looked around again, you would find that it had got itself all together in a heap in the middle of the field, and it had twisted itself up and tied itself into knots and lost its two ends and become all loops. And it would take you a good half hour sitting down there on the grass and swearing all the while to disentangle it again. That is my opinion of tow ropes in general. Of course, there may be honorable exceptions. I do not say that there are not. There may be tow lines that are a credit to their professional conscientiousness. Respectable tow line stow lines that do not imagine they are crochet work and try to knit themselves up into antimassacres the instant they are left to themselves. I say there may be such tow lines. I sincerely hope there are, but I have not met with them. This tow line I had taken in myself just before we got to the lock. I would not let Harris touch it because he is careless. I had looped it round slowly and cautiously and tied it up in the middle, folded it in two, and laid it down gently at the bottom of the boat. Harris had lifted it up scientifically and had put it in George's hand. George had taken it firmly and held it away from him, and had begun to unravel it as if he were taking the swaddling clothes off a newborn infant. And before he had unwound a dozen yards, the thing was more like a badly made doormat than anything else. It is always the same, and the same sort of thing always goes on in connection with it. The man on the bank, who is trying to disentangle it, thinks all the fault lies with the man who rolled it up. And when a man up the river thinks a thing, he says it. What have you been trying to do with it? Make a fishing net of it? You've made a nice mess, you have. Why couldn't you wind it up properly, you silly dummy? He grunts from time to time as he struggles wildly with it and lays it out flat on the toolpath and runs around and round it trying to find the end. On the other hand, the man who wound it up thinks the whole cause of the muddle rests with the man who is trying to unwind it. It was all right when you took it, he exclaims indignantly. Why don't you think what you are doing? You go about things in such a slapdash style. You'll get a scaffolding pole entangled, you would. And they feel so angry with one another that they would like to hang each other with the thing. 10 minutes go by, and the first man gives a yell and goes mad and dances on the rope and tries to pull it straight by seizing hold of the first piece that comes to his hand and hauling at it. Of course, this only gets it into a tighter tangle than before. Then the second man climbs out of the boat and comes to help him, and they get in each other's way and hinder one another. They both get hold of the same bit of line and pull at it in opposite directions, and wonder where it is caught. In the end, they do get it clear, and then turn round and find that the boat has drifted off and is making straight for the dam. This really happened once in my knowledge. I was up by Bovaney one rather windy morning. We were pulling downstream, and as we came around the bend, we noticed a couple of men on the bank. They were looking at each other with a bewildered and helplessly miserable expression as I have ever witnessed on any human countenance before or since, and they held a long tow line between them. It was clear that something had happened, so we eased up and asked them what was the matter. "Why, our boat's gone off," they replied in an indignant tone. "We just got out to disentangle the tow line, and when we looked around, it was gone." And they seemed hurt at what they evidently regarded as a mean and ungrateful act on the part of the boat. We found the truant for them half a mile further down, held by some rushes, and we brought it back to them. I bet they did not give the boat another chance for a week. I shall never forget the picture of those two men walking up and down the bank with a tow line, looking for their boat. One sees a good many funny incidents up the river in connection with towing. One of the most common is the sight of a couple of towers walking briskly along, deep in an animated discussion, while the man in the boat, 100 yards behind them, is vainly shrieking to them to stop, and making frantic signs of distress with the scull. Something has gone wrong. The rudder has come off, or the boat hook has slipped overboard, or his hat has dropped into the water and is floating rapidly downstream. He calls to them to stop, quite gently and politely at first. "Hi, stop a minute, will you?" he shouts cheerily. "I've dropped my hat overboard." Then later, "Hi, Tom, Dick, can't you hear?" Not quite so affably this time. And then even later, "Hi, confound you, you dander-headed idiots, hi, stop, oh, you!" After that, he springs up and dances about and roars himself red in the face and curses everything he knows, and the small boys on the bank stop and jeer at him and pitch stones at him as he is pulled along past them at the rate of 4 miles an hour and can't get out. Much of this sort of trouble would be saved if those who are towing would keep remembering that they are towing and give a pretty frequent look around to see how their man is getting on. It is best to let one person to tow. When two are doing it, they get chattering and forget, and the boat itself, offering as it does but little resistance, is of no real service in reminding them of the fact. As an example of how utterly oblivious a pair of towers can be to their work, George told us later on in the evening when we were discussing the subject after supper of a curious incident. He and three other men, so he said, were sculling a very heavily laden boat up from Maidenhead one evening, and a little above Cookham Lock, they noticed a fellow and a girl walking along the towpath, both deep in an apparently interesting and absorbing conversation. They were carrying a boat hook between them, and attached to the boat hook was a tow line, which trailed behind them, its end in the water. No boat was near. No boat was in sight. There must have been a boat attached to that tow line at some time or other. That was certain. But what had become of it, and what ghastly fate had overtaken it, and those who had been left in it, was buried in mystery. Whatever the accident may have been, however, it had in no way disturbed the young lady and gentleman who were towing.
You have been listening to Episode 7 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for Episode 8 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortune's fame. He never seems to hurry, but he gets there just the same. Kingdoms may come, kingdoms may go, whatever the end may be. All Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. The best way, a heaven best way, just try to be always kind. It doesn't matter what the rest say, you're bound to leave them far behind. It's your job to do your duty, faithful to all your friends, for England and home and beauty, like old Father Thames. High in the hills, down in the lanes, happy and fancy free. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Gets there just the same.